It's time now for Oh the Humanities, looking at humanities scholarship, events, and research on the UNC campus. Joined, as always, by Max Orr, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities, humanities.unc.edu, for more information on them. And even though we are into summer, their work and their events are still ongoing through the summer months, too. Max, how's it going?
It is going just fine. We are, of course, it's not as busy a season for us. It's also a difficult season for me to wrangle up a guest for you, so you're stuck with me, but we have some good topics to discuss.
Sure, we had an econ professor on earlier this hour.
Well, there you go. That covers our...
Patrick Conway... Has got it covered.
Well, so. Patrick Conway will be, in fact, speaking at a seminar next semester.
Awesome.
So it's almost as though we're publicizing next semester. He's actually going to be coming and talking about international trade and globalization next
awesome.
Semester. So I'll come back and tell you all about that.
Very
Maybe
cool.
I'll have Pat with me when I do that.
It was a good conversation. Yeah.
Well, I brought someone with me today. Not really, but I brought their spirit with me today. It's someone's birthday. It's June 3rd, as you know, and it's the birthday of Anderson Cooper.
Hmm.
You know Anderson Cooper.
I do, yeah.
Is Anderson Cooper a journalist?
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
No, my Anderson Cooper, the thing that I think of when I think of Anderson Cooper, like now he does Anderson Cooper 360s, and you know, he's gotten into kind of the celebrity interview kind of thing, but he is a terrific journalist. And the thing that I remember most about him is this had to have been 10 years ago now when the coal mine collapse happened in West Virginia. Mm. He was up there at 3 o'clock in the morning when there was a town hall meeting and they were getting the news that the miners were not coming out, and the people were streaming out of this meeting like angry as hell, and they would go and make a beeline straight up to Anderson Cooper, and he was getting hit at 3 o'clock in the morning with this news that everyone was just getting. And the way he conducted himself and the questions that he was asking were so professional and so good. And like, I've never, or very rarely have I seen someone do journalism on that high a level. He's great.
And I did ask the question in a pointed way because of the accusations that'll be levied against him simply because of the organ that he works for, CNN, has been, you know, criticized from certain perspectives. And of course, Fox News is criticized from the other perspective. And he's one of these figures, you know, these sort of, I guess you're talking head, but he's more than that. He is really a journalist. For me, it was Katrina. And his reporting from Katrina, and what I remember, I don't think it was that necessarily revolutionary. He was sort of doing the personal stories, but what I remember so particular about it is how trusted just about every type of journalist like that was back in 2005, and how much has changed in journalism and in newspapers, and the matter of trust and who do we trust with our information. So I'm hitting on a theme here. I have another.
Okay.
Related to today's date for this theme, in 2013, the trial for Chelsea Manning started, and this was for the WikiLeaks. Now here's the big question:
was that only 6 years ago?
Can you believe it?
Oh, man.
Well, the trial. I think the WikiLeaks leaks themselves were 2010, 2011, and there. I don't know when his particular batch or her particular batch. I should mention that, of course, when she was arrested, she was pre-transition.
Right, as Bradley Manning.
So I don't know where that particular leak came, but certainly 2013, it surprised me as well. It seems like a long time ago. At the same time, it seems kind of recent.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And the reason, of course, it seems recent, I'm going to say the same I'm going to ask you the same question: is Julian Assange a journalist?
Yes, I don't hold him in as high esteem as I hold Anderson Cooper, because Julian Assange has more of an agenda, I think, but yes, absolutely, he's a journalist.
So this is, you know, this is the reason I ask these questions. We have this wonderful seminar coming up on June 15th on new media, the newspaper crisis, and the future of democracy. And it just seems like what we're finding right now is this, we have an information overload, and I'm sure you've talked about it in many areas, different people coming on in this very room, spreading information out over the airwaves.
Right, right.
We have this information overload, and it creates a situation of trust, right? Who do we trust with our information? And not only do we have an information overload, we also have an underload, if that's a way, you know, we also have too little information. And this is kind of what we're looking at in this new media, the newspaper crisis, and the future of democracy on June 15th. We're going to be looking at how too much media has created a situation of no trust, and not enough information has created perhaps the openings for bad information, mm-hmm. trust in bad sources and whatnot.
There's a lot of really interesting points to unpack in there, and I think there is something to be said for 50 people are trying to give you information about a particular thing. 50 people are telling you 50 different things. It makes it very easy to just dismiss all 50 and say, well, I don't trust anyone now. And I think that's to the detriment of political discourse, too.
And not everyone has the ability to come into Aaron Keck's studio to see Aaron, to see Aaron Keck doing some public program out and about, emceeing some public program. What I'm getting is a local sense of our news as well has also deteriorated. Well, two mm-hmm. of the talks, one of them is on by Erin Whitaker. She's a senior research associate in media journalism for the Peace, War, and Defense curriculum at UNC. And she's going to be talking about how news deserts hinder democracy. It's clearly there's a dearth of information. And also Farrell Guillory, who I'm sure you are no professor of the practice
Absolutely.
Of media and journalism and the director of the program on public life, is going to be hitting a similar thing with this fake news and the demise of local newspapers creating these news deserts. So if you don't have a local person, if you don't have Aaron Keck to lean on, you're going to go to the big blogosphere, the big internet and the blogosphere, and grab a hold of somebody to trust. And I think this is one of the things. And what is the effect on democracy? I mean, we're kind of beating a dead horse, right? We've heard of this over and over again, but what's the solution? Mm-hmm. How do we get, do you have any idea?
And it's very difficult. And to go back, a news desert, for people who don't know, is what is the radius that we're talking about? It's basically a local community that just doesn't have local news
coverage,
right?
Doesn't have local news
source. And we're very lucky here in Orange County there's a movement out there of, oh, we've lost the Chapel Hill News, we've lost all mm-hmm. of this, we don't have any news coverage anymore. We do have news coverage, local news coverage in Orange County. We've got us here on WCHL, we've got Chapelburg, we've got the Herald Sun that's still doing mm-hmm. great work, News of Orange up in Hillsboro, WRAL that covers the entire triangle, the DTH focusing on campus but also covering Chapel Hill Carborough, and there's several others that I'm not mentioning right now. So we do have local news, but you go up one county to a Person County or a Caswell County and I don't know what's there, and I don't think people up there know either. And it's not just the lack of news coverage, the lack of local news coverage leading to a lack of information. It also, and I think there's studies on this, and we might have talked about this, the communities where there is less local news coverage or communities where there are news deserts also have a tendency to be more corrupt in their have more corrupt local governments because there's no oversight.
Absolutely. I mean, you feel it every time you go geographically, you're going these sort of like an onion of mm-hmm. levels of administrative responsibility. All politics becomes national, mm-hmm. right? Because you don't have any sort of inroad to your local people or some way of understanding what your local people stand for.
Right.
How do you even reach them? How do you how are you aware of what opponents to them, what they're thinking? So what you do is you just sort of extrapolate from some simplistic idea of national news and make that all news.
Yeah.
And just how detrimental that is to us in terms of one of the great things people always say about how do you fight partisanship is you get to know someone, you have similar interests and share similar things. Well, if you and I are disagreeing nationally about politics, we might come together and say, we both wish that they had more funding for the basketball team at blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And create these political coalitions that are the seeds for true democratic cooperation.
Civic engagement.
Civic
and that happens
engagement.
On the local level, right?
And you can't build a national edifice of bipartisan cooperation if you don't have the seeds of it growing on a yep. local level.
And sort of compounding that is the economic push on news outlets now. Because you think about a local newspaper, for instance, like you think about the Chapel Hill News or even the News and Observer, which is the Raleigh mm-hmm. paper, up until very, very recently, if you run a newspaper and you're printing physical copies of a newspaper, it's very easy to distribute that newspaper around your local community. You've got newsstands, you've got people running around. And
The newspaper route for the boys and girls.
Route, you throw it on the porch, you stick it in the box. Yeah. But it's not easy to get subscribers outside of that community. You can, stick a stamp on it and put it in the mail. And if you're living in Seattle and you really want to subscribe to the NNO because you want to keep up with the Raleigh politics, you can, but you have to actually go out of your way to do that. Now, that we have gone more online. The News and Observer has gone more online. Everyone is sort of gravitating over there. There's no difference in terms of the ease of reaching a consumer who's across the street from you versus 1,000 miles away. And insofar as every news outlet is concerned with increasing page views, there's pressure to focus on the stories that are going to appeal to everyone within a 10,000-mile radius, i.e. national news, versus focusing on the local stuff.
So it homogenizes the content, homogenizes the, you know, I'm sure this is being the pressure from advertising as well. You know, advertisers want to be advertising in a press organ, whether be it online or be it in print. They want to reach a certain demographic and a certain audience. And, you know, we're not so interested in the town of 7,000 people in North Carolina that has had a 150-year-old newspaper and can reach those, you know, 7,000 people.
And we're lucky at WCHL in Chapelboro because people, we can follow the statistics. We've got a whole page of statistics in the kind of the back of our website that we can access. People don't necessarily go to us specifically for national or international news. They've got other outlets for that. They come to us for local stuff. Yeah. They come to us for local stuff, state stuff, what's going on at the General Assembly, UNC Sports, and things like that. So we have more incentive to give people local news because that's what people come to us for. But that's not necessarily the case with a regional newspaper like the NNO. People might go there for all of their news and then they focus more on the national.
And, you know, you're to be lauded as well for the way that news is approached. One of the things that's very depressing, I mean, it can be entertaining if you take a spin through local TV news. And there are some great stations in the area. I don't want to, you know, say it's across the board. But often local stations are under the similar economic pressures. You know, what's going to sell for them are going to be ambulance chasing. Or, you know, it just seems like, of course, we need to know that these things are happening in our area. But there's going to be far more reporting on sort of the sensational stuff that, it's important to know that there was a fire downtown. There was important to know there's a car accident on such and such a street. But, you know, the community council, the town hall meetings, what is going to be the status? What's going to happen with Estes and Franklin up here, you know, on the corner of Estes and MLK, that big clear cutting? These are the types of things that we need to know more about, and you're not going to see them in the local TV coverage as much because they're forced to kind of focus on the sensational in order to keep their dollars going.
And that's
in.
Partly on the consumers of news as well as the outlets, because the outlets, because we are a business, we give people what they want, and what they want is the more sensationalistic stuff. We know that because we can look at page views, we can look at ratings, we can look at ad revenue and things like that. So if you're frustrated with the quality of coverage in the local newspaper or on TV news or on the radio or any other news outlet, pay attention to what you're clicking on. Pay attention to what you're watching, because if you're watching the more sensationalistic stuff, that's what the news outlets are going to gravitate towards.
Just as
providing.
An aside on that, Aaron, in 1937 on June 3rd, more people, if they were able to click at the time, probably would be clicking on the Duke of Windsor marrying Wallace Simpson than they would on what's the latest development of the Nazi horror show going on in Germany.
The more things change, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the one thing, and you're a historian, so you'll hopefully appreciate this. I've read a lot of historical books. And
I do appreciate
books,
that.
Yeah, right? historical books about the media. And one of the things that, and I've said this before, it's simultaneously an optimistic and a pessimistic thing. There's something reassuring and there's something frustrating about it all at the same time, is that none of this is new. Yeah. They're little different iterations on the same old fights. I just read a book called Fake News by Derek Taylor. Fake news spelled as if it's old-timey Old English, about the ongoing battle between the media and the mighty is the way that he characterizes it. And he traces it all the way back to the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg. From that point on, the media becomes at least a potential agent of power which means that it's a threat to mm-hmm. other agents of power, and there's this ongoing battle. Mark Dorison, who's an Orange County sure. commissioner, lent me a book called Nixonland last year, which I read. It's all about the period from 1964 to 72 when Nixon re-rises to prominence. And one of the really fascinating statistics in that book was a survey that was done in, I think, 68 or thereabouts, late 60s, about public trust in the media. Now, 50 years down the road, we've got people on Facebook going, oh, back in my day when yeah. Walter Cronkite was on the air delivering the news. Now, that was real journalism. Exactly. We don't have anything like that today.
The Fairness Club, anything. Fairness Doctrine right. before the FIA.
People had just as little trust in the media in 1968 as they do today. Do yeah. you trust the media to give you the facts without bias? Mm-hmm. People said no then the way that they do today. It's yeah. exactly the same.
Well, that is encouraging and depressing.
And depressing like all at the same time, right? Yeah.
You had an interesting point to say about power, and I'd say the third talk on this, we really wanted to get a different perspective on this. So we're having Bill Marshall, the William Rand Keenan Distinguished Professor of Law, come to talk about these legal aspects of it. His talk is Supreme Court, the First Amendment, and Bad Journalism. Mm-hmm. And what I think is really interesting, some of the things he's going to be talking about, well, first of all, you know, the Julian Assange issue and the Chelsea Manning issue with WikiLeaks has brought up this really thorny legal question about, you know, can journalists protect their sources? Mm-hmm. You know, without journalistic protection, without the protection of sources, many would say investigative journalism will just die completely.
Right.
Because you just need to, and that's all a matter of trust. You know, I trust this journalist is not going to lie to me that someone told them this.
Mm-hmm.
So as we erode the trust in the journalists themselves, we also are making it easier to sort of sow the doubts about this. The other interesting thing is another angle is the attack and our president and some others and even on both sides of the spectrum are very interested in libel laws. You mm-hmm. know, what can you really say about someone in the press? And of course, that's a very slippery slope. If I start saying that, you know, I disagree with this person, say, well, that feels like a personal attack against me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like, no, I'm just telling everyone that you're a terrible person because of your policies. Some things are objective.
Yeah.
But, you know, this should be really interesting because it's a matter of where you have the law, you have people's own passions and desires and how they're interacting with this media and what they're choosing. And, you know, of course, then you have what is the effect on our civil society.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be interesting.
When is it? Where is it?
This is going to be June 15th. It's a weekend seminar, so you do need to go to humanities.unc.edu and register, and that's when we tell you where it is, but it's going to be on UNC campus. It's
awesome. So and there's another event that's coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
We were also going to talk about, but we're running out of time,
mentioning. Let me just say the danger is on June 29th, we have another seminar coming up, another weekend seminar, again, humanities.unc.edu if you'd like to find out more about these. And this one is on authoritarian populism and endangered democracies. So, you know, we don't have to get into that topic, but I think you get a sense of some of the logic of how do we get from, you know, the press to what are the ramifications for organizing society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some populist movements are responding to genuine and economic rage that I can understand, but they do take advantage of this information fuzziness to form coalitions that can be very dangerous. And yep. I think we're seeing that, especially when they play into the hands of authoritarians. That should be a really interesting one on June 29th as well, coming up.
Humanities.unc.edu for more information on all of those seminars and more. Max Orr, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Aaron. Thank you.